Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Labor issues are back in the news with a force unseen in some time. West Coast ports are closed this week, with shipping lines locking out 10,000 longshoremen. It's a classic labor confrontation with accusations of goon tactics on both sides. Though talks resume today, there's muttering that Washington could wade in an attempt to protect the nation's economic health. Meanwhile, on the East Coast, a janitor strike in Boston is attracting considerable community support for the workers. First, it was the students and clergy. Now some of the owners of the companies who contract with the bosses are themselves offering extra cash for the janitors. Many of the workers in this case are already working at 2 to 3 jobs, and they say all they're really looking for is health insurance or a full-time job. Connection listeners, the labor news comes at a time when the captains of corporate America are increasingly appearing in the newspaper wearing handcuffs. So is this a moment for labor to regain its footing? Is this labor's moment? Our number's 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us on the program today, Elaine Bernard. She is executive director of the Labor and Worklife Program at Harvard Law School and a longtime activist herself. Barry Hirsch is joining us. He's a labor economist at Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas. And we're going to start today with Rocio Sayen. She's a deputy trustee of Local 245. It's the Service Employees International Union in New England. Some people say she's one of the sparks behind justice for janitors. Rocio, nice to have you on the phone.
Hi, Dick. Thank you for having us here.
What have you got planned for today?
Well, today we have continued to escalate the strike. More than 1,500 janitors on the strike, so every day continues to increase the numbers. So we are taking the streets, and basically the big issue here is that 3 out of 4 janitors have no health insurance. We're talking a world-class city here in Boston, and janitors are left behind. We have janitors in other cities who have, like New York and Philadelphia, who have been provided health insurance, full-time jobs, good jobs with, you know, higher raises. We just keep asking the question, why not in Boston?
No, I hear stories and read about janitors who are saying, I don't know, I don't want to be on a picket line. I don't want to lose my job. I'm going to go to work. Rocio, what are you saying to them to say, no, in fact, you think they should be on strike?
Well, what we are getting is that workers are joining the picket lines every day. This is the fourth day that we are on a strike, and it's increasing the numbers of workers that are making the big sacrifice and is stepping up and say, this is it, enough is enough. This mainly immigrant workers, and what we're asking for is something that is fair and is good. And I think people are joining more and more the picket lines. We've been gathering so much community support, religious leaders have been pledging to support us continuously, and we have political leaders. And
why do you suppose that is, though, Rocio? I mean, you said just a minute ago you've got mainly immigrant workers. Do you think that's why you'll get someone like the owner of the John Hancock building say, hey, I'll put $1.5 million to the janitor's cause?
I think what is happening is that, you know, this is the work that we've been doing in the past months is trying to bring the visibility of the invisible workers here. Nobody before noticed how the conditions of workers were, especially in these high-rise buildings, prestigious buildings. There were sweatshops at night. So right now, you know, the public can see that this is a real people, car-working people. You know, families that if we get good jobs for them affects everybody, affects our communities. It will be good for Boston.
I made a comparison at the beginning of the program between the justice for janitors that you're talking about and the longshoremen on the West Coast. Do you see a kind of or feel a kind of solidarity with them, or do you just concentrate on people here at this point?
No, I think there is a big connection about workers being you know, united and trying to raise their standards. And we do. We are on the West Coast, East Coast. I think what is important is that workers are bringing to the public light the issues that are important, not just for the work sites, but for our communities. We need to have good jobs in our communities. And the longshoreman workers, if we were here, we'll be joining forces together. And that's very important as we are growing. This is not just a labor issue. This is our community issue. This is an immigrant worker issue. This is a thing that goes beyond of the work site.
Lucio, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Lucio Sáenz is a deputy trustee of Local 245, the Service Employees International Union in New England, and one of the leaders behind the janitor strike that's underway in the Boston area right now. Quick reminder of my other two guests on the program. Elaine Bernard is with me in the studio. She's executive director of the Labor and Worklife Program at Harvard Law School and a union activist herself. Barry Hirsch is joining us on the line from Texas, where he's a labor economist at Trinity University in San Antonio. And I'll start with you. Barry, just on the last words that we had from Rocio about this being more than just a labor dispute, but something about changing the community, changing the status of workers in America. Are you hearing something in that that's bigger than just a strike?
Yes, Dick. I think that's generally correct. This, I think, is a moment, or at least one of several moments, that public support for low-wage workers and perhaps labor issues in general are coming together. I'm less sure that this is a moment for labor unions and labor organizing. I think it's less likely that justice for janitors and concern for low-wage workers will produce any resurgence in union organizing in general.
Elaine Bernard, this is a country that always struggles with labor issues, unlike European countries and Canada, where unions remain much stronger than they are in the United States. You've still got that sense in this country that among many people that unions are the sand in the gears of commerce. And I'm wondering whether or not you see in what we're talking about today anything that indicates change in that.
Yeah, I definitely do, especially, as Barry said, with the low-waged workers, the service workers. It's been a long time since unions have been seen as organizations that speak for not just their own members, but a much wider group. And I think programs and campaigns like Justice for Janitors is exactly that type of image of the labor movement, not just as an organization, but as a movement, as a social movement. I guess this is a period where you could say labor's putting the movement back into labor movement.
But contrast that with what's happening on the West Coast with the longshoremen, where people see workers who already have health insurance, who already have a reasonably good wage, who already have full-time jobs, being going head-to-head with managers who are saying, the food's rotting in the crates, the Christmas toys won't be delivered. That it's what a dramatic difference from the way that this one's being portrayed in the East Coast. Is it all PR?
Well, I think a lot of it is PR, because another way of looking at it is here's a group of workers who've organized, who've agreed to accept all sorts of technological change. I mean,
this is the dock workers you're talking
absolutely
about.
Absolutely. Yeah. They run big cranes. They are one of the most productive and efficient workforces in the world. And they're now being told new technology is coming in and we don't want to talk to you about that. And it's quite understandable that the union's using all of its economic leverage to say, talk with us.
Now, Barry Hirsch, you've written in your papers that unions, on balance, are not good for America. Right?
I would not characterize it quite that way. I have done a good bit of work looking at union effects on profitability, investment, productivity, and there the findings, on average, are not so positive.
Yeah, what's the key there? What do you point to make that point?
Well, unions, one way to think of them is they're trying to help their workers. One way can be through improved communications in ways that might increase productivity in the workplace. The other is through raising wages and benefits, and in many ways that acts as a tax on corporate or firm profits. I think most economists are very much in favor of any productivity enhancing or voice aspects of unions. They're more concerned about the taxing aspects of unions, and it's that latter that seems to dominate in many workplaces, particularly in what has become a very competitive world.
And so couldn't I just go at this from the reverse and say that at a time when the economy is very weak, maybe it's not labor's moment because every penny might matter even more?
I agree.
1-800.
I agree. I think this is a difficult time to see any really resurgence in unionism. One way to think of this is that any point in time, an economy is constantly both destroying or losing jobs, some of which are unionized, and creating new jobs. During a recession, few new jobs are being created. Jobs that are being created are almost always non-union, and unions have to work very, very hard to organize new non-union jobs into union jobs just to stay in place, and that's what they've been struggling doing. Union campaigns are very, very costly, and they have to fund those from their dues, which they're getting from a shrinking base of union members. So unions face a tremendous difficulty in organizing. On the other hand, I do agree with Elaine that unions being more associated with labor issues in general, and particularly for low-wage workers, that really does have some traction and can gather public support.
When you were talking about the importance and the cost of organizing, Elaine was nodding her head. This is something that you've talked and written about yourself.
Sure. It's U.S. law, labor law, is really a series of barriers over which workers have to climb in order to get a right that they were promised in 1935, the right to engage in protected collective activity. And the law makes it extremely difficult for workers to organize. We know this. There's been polls recently that show over 50% of private sector workers, if given the opportunity, would vote for a union.
But 50% of the drives fail, right? Isn't that about right?
Absolutely. And it does, not because, you know, the workers are in what the law used to call a laboratory conditions where they can freely debate the pros and cons of whether or not to organize, but in fact they're faced with law firms and $1 million union avoidance campaigns that make it extremely difficult. And of course, threats by employers with very little ability to stop these attempts to prevent unionization. So it's a really difficult battle in the United States.
Okay, but quickly, do you see this in any way changing, Elaine? I mean, you've described a situation which would have been applicable in 1990. Now, 2002. Economy going down, people a little bit suspect. Is it changing?
Sure, it's changing. It's changing for a number of reasons. One is
give me your best one, because we're going to have to go to a break.
Okay, the labor movement itself has changed, but second, so has corporate America. I need only mention Enron, WorldCom. There's a lot less confidence in corporate America. Workers realize that they need, that only they themselves can seek their best interests.
It is, Connection listeners, an issue of leadership. Who do people turn to for the type of leadership on a social level as well as a labor level, a workplace level? 1-800-423-8255. White collar, blue collar, organizing and talking about a change in the wind for labor. Do you agree that it's there, or is it just a moment that will pass? 1-800-423-8255. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. And those are the janitors in Boston demanding fair wages. Today we're talking about the prospects of the labor movement in the face of a tight economy. With me in the studio, Elaine Bernard. She's executive director of the Labor and Work-Life Program at Harvard Law School. And joining us on the line, Barry Hirsch, professor of economics at Trinity University, San Antonio, Texas. And our telephone number, Connection listeners, 1-800-423-TALK. We'll start with John in Newport News, Virginia. Hi, John.
Hey, hello, and thank you for taking my call, Dick.
Yeah, go ahead.
My point was that the way I see the janitors versus the longshoremen, and you brought this together earlier on, was that it's almost what labor unions used to be for versus what labor unions have become. It seems as though that labor has become almost an industry in and of itself, and whereas the plight of the janitors in Boston, I mean, those are very real, very valid concerns that, you know, they need health insurance, they need a livable wage. But the longshoreman, it tends to be kind of for the union. It seems to be something that's what they've become. I'd be interested to hear your guests' take on that.
Hi, it's Elaine. I would question whether, throwing the longshore workers out and removing their health care and their good pay constitutes, you know, some sort of success. I think that, you know, they've succeeded in creating a standard that the janitors only hope at some point to reach. I think that they're not standing for an organization. They're standing for, you know, the dignity and their rights to participate in decision-making that really affects them and the whole community.
Though John talks about an interesting perception of labor that's crept into the country, that of, you know, working for the union boss rather than working for yourself, making sure that, you know, the dues are paid. Barry Hirsch, you talk about the Independent Workers Association as maybe something that, you know, might at some point in the future replace that. Have I got that right?
Yes, a lot of people have talked about that. What the National Labor Relations Act and current labor law prohibits companies from establishing worker councils or elected worker groups, so-called company unions, and the labor movement has tended to be strongly opposed to any changes in those laws. I think that can come in the future, but I don't think it'll come during a Republican administration. The labor movement simply is too distrustful, correctly so, of labor law changes that could take place. I could imagine such things taking place in a more labor-friendly administration in Congress.
Sure. The one strength of American labor law is that it assumes workers will form their own organization, not the employer and not the state, which is very different than Europe and a lot of other countries. And it means that the leaders in the American labor movement, come up from the ranks of the workers. So it's really a unique institution. You hear someone like earlier this morning, Rocio. I mean, Rocio is someone who has worked as a janitor. She's a leader of janitors now, but she's someone who really understands the work. She comes up from the ranks. If you talk to the leader of the longshore, he was a longshore worker. It's a remarkable institution and something that I think is very important. It's
John,
not labor bosses.
Let me just add there that my concern is less with the 10% of private sector workers who are unionized. Their unions do provide a good voice for workers. My concern is with the 90% of private sector workers who do not have representation and I think desire and would like more voice in the workplace and more cooperation with management. And there, I don't see that being served by labor unions. I think it's unlikely that it will be. And that's where I would like to see some changes in the law that might allow that to take place.
Just briefly back to John in Virginia. Are you in a union, John?
No, I'm not, but I do work in a union environment part-time. And I think what sort of illustrates my point is having read an article 2 years ago in the newspaper that mentions, typical auto manufacturing worker. He's a forklift driver that's making in excess of six figures. And I think that's kind of demonstrates the excesses that I was talking about.
Gee, I'd like to join that union.
Yes, so
thanks for your call, John.
Thank you for your time.
1-800-423-8255. Cambridge, Massachusetts. Jeff's on the line. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I would just like to say I was trying to organize helping the textile workers back in the 70s, and I couldn't in good conscience go into people's living rooms and promise them that the federal government protected their right to organize, because it just became the companies would try everything, as Elaine pointed out earlier, to break the law and hire these anti-union consulting firms and drag out the process so that their right to organize was effectively frustrated.
But is anything different now?
Well, no. Actually, we tried to change the law in the 70s, and a filibuster mounted by the Republicans and some conservative Democrats held up the Senate for 19 days. We were, 59 votes and holding, and the Senate finally had to move on. But those changes were put off, and I don't see them even coming up anymore. As Barry said, Republicans certainly aren't going to do it, and I just don't think, even if you had a Democrat in there, we had one.
I guess what
years.
I'm getting at, Jeff, is that in the face of the situation that you describe, I think it's fair to say that the janitors are succeeding in making their point. So is that an indicator of change or just an anomaly?
It is an incredible, incredible story. I mean, these workers really have to struggle and fight, and the unions, as Barry pointed out, have to spend, tons of money to organize workers. But it is possible. But you really have to do what this SEIU union has done and engage the community and really, tell the story of how these workers, aren't making it, even when they work for fabulously wealthy employers.
Barry Hirsch, I don't know that they would have been able to do it without the degree of community support that Jeff's talking about, though.
No, absolutely. I mean, they've had several things they've been able to do. First, they've been able to focus on a small number of cleaning supply firms. Were there hundreds out there, they would not be able to focus their attention on that. Secondly, they've been able to gather public pressure on both the building owners and the large companies that are occupying those buildings, and it's that combination that is putting quite a bit of pressure and will free up some of the money.
And what if the argument was taking place in Dallas or Houston, where there is not any kind of tradition of organization? Would the janitors be getting the sort of support that we're seeing in Boston?
They would be getting some, but certainly not to the degree that you're seeing in Boston or saw in L.A.
All right.
I think it would be very difficult to organize there. I don't know much about the cleaning supply industry in those cities. If it were highly concentrated among a couple of firms, then it might have some chance of success.
Well, Elaine knows the details here.
Right. I think the key thing is that the janitors' union is creating a movement, and movements don't pay a whole lot of attention to the law in the sense of, gee, labor law is terrible, it's very restrictive. Sure, but the civil rights movement overcame that, and the new labor movement, the labor movement that the janitors represent, is basically saying, let's ignore the law, let's not follow the National Labor Relations Act, let's in fact engage in protected collective activity, and let's create a social
organized
movement.
Form of civil disobedience? Does it go that far?
Sure, they've done that. They've done all sorts of activities. In the past, when collective bargaining was banned, people didn't cease to bargain. They engaged in bargaining in a different way. And it was jokingly referred to as collective bargaining by riot. And so I think what we're seeing today is that the labor movement is saying, look, the National Labor Relations Act promised us the right to engage in protected collective activity. If it won't guarantee that promise, then we will create a movement, a powerful movement, that will in fact engage in collective activity to increase our wages.
Yeah, but we're talking here about a group of people who automatically attract the interest, the affection, and the sympathy of average Americans who acknowledge that somewhere below the floor that most people consider the poverty level are the people working two and three jobs a day, barely keeping up. I guess I'm not persuaded, Elaine, that the same principles you're describing would cover folks on a shop floor at a place putting together some auto parts or public sector workers in Philadelphia with the same degree of support.
Well, I think it's more than just whether the public supports it. It's also whether the workers feel that they need to engage in some sort of activity. For instance, you often hear that unions were important back when children were in mines. Well, we aren't putting children in mines, but we are putting them in fast food places where they're facing very dangerous conditions and being paid very bad wages. So we're seeing I'm in a university, we're seeing an increased interest in unions and organization among young people. On the internet, the wires are burning up with interest.
Be careful of judging the world by the internet.
Well, the under 30 world can be judged by the internet.
Yes.
And that's the next generation.
All right. 1-800-423-8255. Jeff, thanks for your call. We're going to Charleston, South Carolina now. Amy's on the line. Hi there.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a former IBM employee, and I know that the Communications Workers of America have been trying to unionize there for some time. And I could not tell as an employee if that was a big or small effort. And I wondered, first of all, what your guests, if they knew anything about that effort. But then also wanted to say that in general, that information technology as a field is one that's got very harsh working conditions and that's seen a lot of jobs go offshore. And I just wondered if, in general, in that field, what your guests thought about that field in general.
Before I turn to Barry on this one, Amy, let me just ask you whether or not you were in any way inclined to go to the meetings and take a look at the union when they were making their pitch.
Well, I was not in a physical location that would enable me to go to meetings, but, I certainly followed their efforts for a couple of years and,
right.
and was very tempted. I just, I really couldn't tell if it would do any good or not, honestly.
Barry, let's go to you first.
Kind of related to that, we've discussed a little bit unions communicating with workers. Elaine mentioned the internet. The internet has provided a very effective vehicle for unions having the ability to reach a lot of people they would not otherwise be able to, given that unions are restricted by most firms from communicating with workers in the workplace. The internet serves as at least a partial substitute for that. More generally, and I don't have any specific knowledge about IBM, if you think what unions do is they tend to formalize the workplace arrangement, and they take away managerial discretion and put things in contracts, and that can work pretty well where workers don't trust management, where there's a very hierarchical work arrangement. More and more in today's workplace, that does not describe today's workplace. You have a lot of communication going on at all levels. Management discretion is often a good thing if you have good management. So that doesn't address the question directly, but I think the more general point here is that in many of today's workplaces, workers don't necessarily perceive that a more formal work arrangement would be preferable to what they now face.
I'm really familiar with the group at IBM. It's called Alliance at IBM and was started by the communication workers. And it's got two really interesting features. One is that it's not a union in the sense of a union hall. It's a union without walls. It's done through communications on the internet. It does have a membership base. And the Communication Workers Union are doing this type of organizing with high-tech workers, WashTech in Washington. Very interesting experiment. That's one part. The second part is it shows that you don't actually need to have a majority in order to have tremendous influence. What Alliance at IBM was started when IBM unilaterally changed the pension plan of a majority of its fairly well-paid technical workers, and they rebelled. And they rebelled by forming an organization. That organization caused enough movement within the company that the company was forced to step back from that decision, which shows you what collective activity can do.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Amy, quick last question for you. If you were to join a union, then you might be faced with a situation where you'd have to go into one of the buildings that's being picketed by the janitors and choose about crossing a picket line, stuff like that. Do you think about it in those terms? Oh, Amy's left us. Sorry about that. Where are we going next? To Burlington, Vermont, and Jerry's joining us. Hi, Jerry.
Yeah, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
I have two comments. One was I want to just quickly say about the guy, caller a little while ago, who said in Mike, he's heard of forklift workers making six figures. That's a lot of crap. When I worked in the auto industry, we were said to be making, this is a way back, we were said to be making like $20 an hour, but that computes in the retirement and benefits you may never see, you know, sick benefits, whatever it may be. So the your wage is nothing like that, so don't be fooled by that. The other thing is I've worked in four unions in my lifetime, been sold out, you know, me and the others were sold out by like three.
By the unions.
I'm not anti-union. I'm anti what unions become, and that's what this Barry fellow seems to be pushing for. The role of unions is not to increase productivity. The role in unions is to get more money for its workers. And the whining of bosses that we're not making money, all the givebacks, all of those things, all of the cuts in wages, all the cuts in benefits, have eroded the viability. Not only the viability, but the way people look at unions. Is that what union does to me? It sells my benefits out. My pension disappears. That's not a union.
Isn't it fair to say that it was the union that got that pension and the benefit and the wages in the first place?
Yes, that's right, and then later sold it out. And to what end? If you look at what happened with Chrysler, for example, I didn't work for Chrysler,
right.
I worked for Ford. But if you look at what happened to Chrysler, they said, give us back and we won't lay you off. Well, they gave it back and they laid them off. You know,
okay,
that's
Elaine.
The reality.
Yeah, I think he's referring to the various unions that have taken concessions in order to try and maintain the profitability of a firm.
Airline unions, for example.
Absolutely. And that generally is just a sign of whether or not the organization is weak, whether it feels, you know, most unions don't want their employer to go bankrupt. If the employer goes bankrupt, they're out of a job. So this notion that, you know, that unions are always pushing for higher and more benefits just isn't true. They're looking for a prosperous firm, but they want to make sure that the workers gain some of that prosperity. We forget that, you know, what Barry called the tax on employment, that is, in fact, that tax that is, in fact, wages and benefits. And we forget that if an employer doesn't pay that, these people don't disappear. If you don't get health insurance from your employer, where are you going to get it? Well, we got 44 million Americans without health insurance, and it costs all of us.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. This hour, a conversation about labor's moment in the United States, whether or not with all the attention being paid to the longshoremen's lockout on the West Coast, the Justice for Janitors strike on the East Coast, is this a time when people are giving organized labor a second look in the country after a considerable period of decline? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. This hour, about labor at this moment in the United States. With me in the studio, Elaine Bernard, Executive Director of the Labor and Worklife Program at Harvard Law School, and Barry Hirsch is on the line from Trinity University in Texas, where he works in the Department of Economics. And we're going to Boston, where Jim's calling in. Hi, Jim.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm a retired CEO of a large construction company, which we voluntarily unionized in the mid-80s and have had some interesting experiences with unions, mostly very positive, but see the role of unions, at least in the building trades, is really changing in the last 15 years.
You know, I mean, the history in the country is for management to see unions as some kind of personal offense. You know, you're going to unionize my shop because I'm not doing a proper job of caring for you and your family. What was different in your case?
We went to the trade unions because we were unable in the mid and late 80s to find an adequate supply of skilled workers. There was a huge divide in Boston at that time in both wages and skills between union and non-union workers. That's shrunk quite a bit, I think, in the last 15 years.
So 15 years later, do you see that the unions as still being viable?
Absolutely. We also work nationally in many cities where there are no unions at all, and we see the difference in Boston and Chicago and San Francisco and heavily unionized cities. Construction is a career and a profession for people. In many of the western and southern cities that we work in, it's really a transient job of sort of last resort.
Just a quick last question for you, Jim. When you're talking to other managers and making the same case, are there people who are raising their eyebrows and saying, you're nuts, you know?
Well, it's interesting. I've negotiated a couple of contracts and been on committees. Our issues with the unions are not over wages and benefits. We feel that they're appropriate for the work and the skill that people bring. Our issues with the union, frankly, are more the lack of cooperation between the unions and the politics and administration that goes on in unions today.
When you say lack of cooperation between the unions, do you mean somebody wanting to or not wanting to cross someone else's picket line, someone trying to get parity with a job that doesn't compare? I'm not sure I understand what you mean.
I'm talking about the trades, the different unions, the Carpenters Union and the iron workers,
right,
fighting over who installs
I've got you.
Window. And the whole job stops, and issues like that really make not only us as an employer, but our unionized people really crazy.
And less efficient at the same time.
Absolutely.
Jim, thanks for your call.
You're welcome.
Nice to hear that point of view. 1-800-423-8255.
Dick, I can add a little bit on that. I mean, he's entirely correct that the construction industry has shifted from being, in the early 70s, highly unionized, about 40% of workers, high paid and high skilled, toward today, where less than 20% of workers are unionized and tending to be far lower skill and lower pay. At least a part of that is changes in building technology, particularly in home building, whatnot. So now union construction is highly concentrated in large building construction and tending to be in large cities. So at least a part of that, I think, reflects technological changes.
You don't need the same level of electrical skill and plumbing skill that you would have 10 or 15 years ago?
A lot of prefabricated building and whatnot.
But one of the things the union brought to that industry was, in fact, joint labor management funded training programs.
Absolutely.
That created the skill level. They've also overcome a lot of the, you know, there's 18 trades in the building trades, so you can appreciate that there's some what they call jurisdictional disputes. But they've overcome that on large projects like the Big Dig project. You don't hear anything about that because there's project labor agreements that make possible rules of the game well in advance agreed to. Now, one of the sad things, once again, with this current Republican administration is that they've decided they don't like project labor agreements and are trying to stop them.
1-800-423-8255 to Bill, who's on the line from Corolla, North Carolina. Hi, Bill.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
Terrific discussion. I want to put on the table the issue of support for unions when they're advocating for low-paid workers, but kind of this notion that somehow the high-paid, well-paid workers that the unions have fought for over many years somehow are less deserving of that public support. And I think about the issue of corporate CEO pay. Nobody says, maybe now they're beginning to recognize that CEOs are way overpaid. Certainly, if you put it on a merit scale, they're way overpaid. I think about Major League Baseball players, for example, and we just went through a period where there was almost a strike there, and people were talking about the greedy players. Well, the greedy players were just trying to hold on to the standards that they had won. I mean, they weren't looking build up, you know, obscene salaries.
You don't think someone who's bargaining for a $3 or $4 or $14 million contract makes it harder for the other people who are arguing for a living wage?
Yeah, but 30 years ago, I think the average pay in Major League Baseball was $26,000.
So what does that say about the janitors, that they're not going to expect $26 million in 20 years? I mean, I guess I just don't know that. Working people see themselves as part of a, as in the same league.
I think we're certainly not in the same league with those highly skilled, like, major league professional ball players. But the whole idea of raising a standard, so that ball players who we consider to be superstars 30 years ago, you know, live their lives in poverty because they didn't have a pension.
Right. So Elaine.
And it's an immensely prosperous industry. It's not the ballplayers' demands aren't putting the baseball monopoly, and it is, in fact, a monopoly, out of business. They're just looking for a share to go to the people who are actually producing the product, which is the players. So even though they're getting very high salaries compared to the wealth of the industry, it's not so bad. Actually, the most organized sector in the U.S. economy is public safety. That's police, fire, and emergency health ETMs. And I don't think anybody would deny them the pay they receive for the job they do. And the funny thing is that, you know, if you think about police, fire, and emergency personnel, there's two aspects to it. One is we want those people to have decent wages and decent working conditions because we need them when there's an emergency. But the second thing is we want them, as we're learning more and more as we move to a country worried about security, we want them to be able to be whistleblowers. We want them to have the protection of an organization in order to be able to have a voice. And that's a whole other aspect.
George Bush doesn't.
Well, we do, but yes, President Bush doesn't with the current legislation that he's trying to pass on Homeland Security, where, in fact, he's seeking to take away the rights of public safety folks from being able to organize.
So Barry Hirsch, can you talk about organized labor in the United States in any way that describes it as a movement, or do you need to separate, you know, the construction trades from the baseball players, from the janitors, from the police and fire people when you're trying to assess the health of labor?
Yeah, I mean, I think the answer is both. It is definitely a movement, and there's some commonality across all these examples, but each bargaining situation in each industry and occupation is very different. And looking at something like Major League Baseball versus justice for janitors are certainly two extremes.
But I look at the front cover of my New York Times today and see a photograph of Andy Fastow in handcuffs, the chief financial officer of Enron, and think to myself, okay, if people want leadership, and if they feel that they're not getting leadership on bread and butter issues because the politicians are too busy talking about war and the corporate captains of industry are watching their the money they've squirreled away disappear, if they're looking for the kind of feed the family, pay the rent type leadership, does organized labor offer an option for them? First to Barry, then to Elaine. Go ahead.
Possibly. I mean, I definitely agree that to the extent that there is an increase in worker distrust of management, then workers are going to be more sympathetic to what a union might do. Unions look at the books, they formalize the work relationship, they provide a voice, and I don't see huge changes coming. I don't know that this is the moment, but I think it certainly is having an effect.
It's a moment of crisis, and we'd all agree it's a moment of crisis as far as the economy. It's a moment of crisis, certainly with the potential of war against Iraq in security. And so a moment of crisis, what happens is people, you know, pull together around their family and their community. And what a union is a community of interest in the workplace. So I think, especially because of the economic crisis we're in today, that more and more workers are going to look to creating some sort of community of interest.
But what about that whole sort of rugged individualist, spine-stiffening sense of I am an American, I can just do fine, you know, without the assistance of a union and whatever dues it'll take out of my check?
Well, I think, if we think about that, we would say, why are police organizing? Police are amongst the most highly organized sector in the economy. It's because they also recognize as well as being rugged individuals, that they need some sort of collective protection.
Let's try and sneak in a last call. We'll go to Frank, who's in Suffolk, Virginia. Hi, Frank.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, are you in a union?
Yes, I am, but I'm in a particular situation where I'm in a union, but it's more of like a social club because we can't collectively bargain. I'm a firefighter, and I'm with the IAFF, but we can't collectively bargain in Virginia because it's against the rules.
You can't go on strike, more to the point, right?
Well, no, not so much that. We can't sit down, you know, with the administration of our cities and talk to them about issues that affect us. We have to do it through the back door, per se. And, you know, Congress has been trying to get us, or some people in Congress are trying to get us a law passed that would provide all 50 states with the guarantee that we could actually do it.
Well, take us back to the historical sense of what organized labor is. Are the dock workers, are the janitors your brothers and sisters in this?
Oh, definitely. There definitely is a sense of solidarity, I think. You know, the corporations are the folks that they're worried about the bottom line and profitability. That's what their main focus is. They drive the economy. But we as the workers need to have a voice of our own. And the federal government pretty much has failed in a lot of areas to be our advocate in this area.
Barry Hirsch, you wrote that there can be no rebound in labor's strength in the United States unless there's a major shift in worker attitudes regarding capitalism. Is that any part of what you're hearing here?
Yeah, I think so. The scenario that Elaine has described is a possibility. I think the pressures against that are probably too great, and I don't see this happening. I think it's a low likelihood. But, of course, if you go back to the early 1930s, when unionization was at about 10%, what it is now in the private sector, everybody was looking forward and saying unionization isn't going anywhere. And, of course, it did go. There was a huge shift in public attitudes along with the Depression and the New Deal and the change in labor law, and unionization took off.
Let me just give
such a scenario
quick
is possible. I just think it's unlikely.
Last word, Elaine, to you, because sure. We keep coming back to the law and whether or not that can ever be addressed.
You're asking me to predict the future, and I'll tell you the way unions think. The best way to predict the future is to create it, and I think they're trying to create a more just and democratic future for all of us.
Thanks so much for being part of the program.
Thank you.
Elaine Bernard is Executive Director of the Labor and Work Life Program at Harvard Law School. Barry Hirsch, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Barry's Professor of Economics at Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas. Earlier in the program, we talked with Rocio Saenz, Deputy Trustee of Local 245. That's the Service Employees International Union in New England. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Farming boys from Texas and the hills of Tennessee. There's miners from Kentucky, there's fishermen from Maine. Every worker in the country rides that farmer labor train. This train pulled into Washington a bright and happy day. When she steamed into the station, you could hear the people say, there's that farmer labor special, she's full of union men, heading on the White House on the farmer labor train.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be.